Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and thank you for listening. Please tell your like-minded friends out there, or those who may not be like-minded, to subscribe to the show wherever they get their podcast, and of course, to subscribe to the show on YouTube as well. I have a quote for you, and let me just read it right here. If they have a problem with the idea of using the power that we have while we still have it to protect the most vulnerable in our state, I don't know why the hell they're a Democrat. Wow, that was progressive Democratic state representative and friend of the show, Betsy Cafia, from the 103rd District around the Traverse City area, an area that also features rural areas where Democrats have been struggling of late. That's right, Betsy Cafia, who I mentioned on last week's show, talked with our good friend John King from Michigan Advance this weekend. And the quote I just shared with you was Representative Cafia expressing her frustrations over the Democratic majority's inability, gross inability, to use the power that it has in the State House. Now, as all of you know, State House Democrats lost the majority in this election, and that means starting on January 1st, MAGA Republicans led by the insufferable Matt Hall, who is a horrific gambler but knows best what to do with the state's money, apparently, that's when he will now be the Speaker of the House. So, in the meantime, the Democrats have a chance to pass some of the major bills that they've been delaying here for far too long in the lame duck session, but they're, for some reason, not really moving all that fast to pass these kinds of bills that'll help so many people across the state. Now, Representative Cafia won her state house seat by less than 800 votes back in 2022. Naturally, she says she was told by some of the very smart people in Lansing that she had to tack towards more of the center and you know, not really be bold if she wanted to win re-election. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the basic gist. But here, I will quote Betsy Cafia from her Twitter posting that was shared in that John King story, and I quote here, "I was outright told by Lansing insiders," she had that in quotation marks, "that I should be afraid to take these votes. I wasn't. I stood firm that I could be honest and upfront with my community that I'm, you know, a Democrat, and also earn their respect for being deeply loyal to my community and its people before all, and deliver the goods for them. I never hid from my votes." Now, that's Betsy Cafia showing right there how she stood firm and voted for progressive legislation while also showing that progressivism is all about getting stuff done, even sometimes on a bipartisan basis when it is needed, because progressive sense is common sense. And because she was a strong progressive fighter, Betsy Cafia outperformed her 2022 numbers and won by over 3,000 votes this election. Like she said, she told them that she was a Democrat who cared about her community, and she passed progressive and smart bills that helped her community. It's not rocket science here, everybody. Work hard for the hardworking people in your district. Hey, Democrats, if you do that, you win. Unfortunately, the Democratic majority in the State House hasn't necessarily gotten that message. They're spending their time right now running around, wasting away this lame duck session to get many meaningful bills passed. Bills like housing, like polluter pay to ensure that businesses clean up their messes rather than taxpayers footing the bill. Bills on transit, labor rights, criminal justice reform, reproductive rights, allowing immigrants to get a state ID or driver's license regardless of their immigration status, because that'll help so many hardworking immigrants in the state, which will help businesses. There are bills out there that would expand hate crimes, and there are bills that would help make long overdue changes to how sex education is taught right here in Michigan. I mean, that's just a few of the important things. And one thing that the Democratic majority, though, is concentrating on is watering down the upcoming changes to the state's minimum wage and paid sick leave laws. Because when powerful lobbyists like the restaurant and bar lobbyists want to get something changed in Lansing, oh, baby. They get the ear of many politicians just like that. Unfortunately, normal, hardworking people don't have that kind of access. Outgoing Democratic State Representative Rachel Hood of Grand Rapids refused to run for re-election because of the joke that Lansing has become. And in one final act of protest, or maybe even desperation, Representative Hood has refused to attend the Capitol until the Democratic majority is real serious about passing true progressive policies instead of always kowtowing to corporate interests. Representative Betsy Cafia told Michigan Advance's John King the following, and I quote here, When Republicans get power, they use it, they go all in, said Cafia, who noted that she grew up in a Republican household that listened regularly to Rush Limbaugh and utilized Right to Life voting guides. And Cafia continues, what I know is Republicans understand power. They use it to the fullest extent when they have it. And that's agnostic to whether it's good or bad. It's just an understanding in a way to approach power. Betsy Cafia gets it. Many other progressive Democrats get it. Why isn't the Democratic leadership in Michigan getting it? Republicans never care how things get done when they're in power. They just get it done. They get their agenda passed. I told you recently to never forget how they used the 2018 lame duck session to pass a bill allowing that expensive tunnel to be built around the rickety and antiquated Canadian Line 5 oil pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. I mean, that basically blocked incoming Governor Gretchen Whitmer at the time and Attorney General Dana Nessel from trying to close down the pipeline. They could have done it, but the Republicans passed a bill blocking them from doing it. And everything involving Line 5 and that so-called tunnel and everything is still held up in the courts. Meanwhile, oil continues to flow under the Straits of Mackinac. Why? Because Republicans used their power when they had it. Democrats had better start using their power to show people that they will fight for them. And they've got to show that they will fight for them up to the very last minute. Stop with decorum and stop with trying to play nice with MAGA Republicans. You guys keep punching yourselves in the face. Stop doing it. Those days are over. The days of decorum are over, as if, you know, they really ever existed. Progressive Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf also won their re-election for the 77th State House District just a couple of weeks ago, and that district is in Ingham, Clinton, and Eaton counties. It's got urban, suburban, and rural voters, and Emily Diefendorf got re-elected because they ran as a strong and smart progressive Democrat who fights for the working people, whether they live in more populated areas or if they live on family farms. The representatives got some meaningful legislation ready to be passed. In fact, one of their bills received widespread bipartisan support, but those bills aren't doing much right now because we can't get the Democratic leadership to get things moving. And yes, I know Republicans won't lift a finger on anything, but who does that shock? Does that shock really anybody? No. Of course, MAGA Republicans aren't going to help hardworking people. It's not what they're about, but progressive Democrats have and are trying to get these things done for their fellow Michiganders while they still have the power. Instead of alienating the base, instead of alienating hardworking people, maybe the Democratic leadership, and I'm looking at you too, Big Gretch, maybe you guys should all start to get the ball rolling. Representative Emily Diefendorf is coming up here in just a few moments. You're listening to LOL.
Listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough, then you are in need of more Pat. Follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget, you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
Just wanted to add a reminder to subscribe to Left of Lansing on YouTube. Soon I will begin doing some YouTube live videos so I can interact with you and others will be on. And I'm sure the algorithms at YouTube will lead to certain other people being there, I'm sure. And that'll be a sight to see. And also, please subscribe to the podcast and give it a 5-star review. Also, thanks for listening and thanks for all of your emails. They mean a lot. Right now, I am happy to have someone on the show who's a true progressive fighter in the State House and who represents the 77th House District, which is around the North Lansing, DeWitt, and Watertown Township areas, and that comprises of Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. It's got a mix of urban, suburban, and rural areas, and Representative Emily Devendorf has been able to successfully connect with voters there thanks to their style of championing progressive, common-sense values, values which will help the future of the state and the nation, hopefully, in the long run. And in fact, the representative defeated their MAGA Republican opponent by a 60-40% margin, which means their much-needed voice will be heard once Republicans take the majority gavel in the State House at the start of the new year. So Representative Emily Devendorf, thanks so much for taking some of your time out to talk with us this week.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. This is an important time to talk.
It is. And congratulations on your reelection. My first question to you, Representative, is actually a question from a family member of mine. In a year where Democrats really faced a lot of headwinds from the electorate, be it on the federal or the state level, how exactly did you win reelection in your district? And what messages did you communicate to the voters to win their trust again to get another term in the State House?
Well, for me, that's a really easy answer because I make it a practice to not champion legislation that my community has not flagged as being important to them. So I echoed their priorities in the legislature. I echoed their concerns about access to basic needs. I really doubled down on our need for a more transparent and participatory democracy. And I also was and remain very committed to representing the interests of my whole district and finding that common ground. And I think that we do have plenty of that, which will help us right now. But nothing that I have put forward is anything that would shock or upset my district. And I know that some folks also feel strongly that that is their approach, and that's why they stay away from some issues. I am very lucky to have a community that supports fighting for the most vulnerable.
And here's the thing, and I think we talked about this the last time you were on here. Your district is quite diverse, and while you did a great job in getting a big majority of voters in Ingham County, you also narrowly defeated your Republican opponent in Eaton County, and I think you were within single digits of your opponent in rural Clinton County. So I think that right there just shows that your message obviously resonates well with all voters, including those in rural areas.
I certainly believe so. I have done a lot of work to stay in communication with folks in rural areas, but also to fill in my own blanks to ensure that I am educating myself in areas that may not be my areas of expertise, because of course I come from civil rights. I'm used to working on hate, which we can certainly talk about at some point in this interview, but I have become really passionate about farming because of its potential for helping to establish equity and fairness for all of our communities. And I also have worked very hard to ensure that any economic development that we do considers the needs of our community members and that everybody has a say in what's happening in their backyard without entertaining xenophobia. There are very bright lines that I respect in terms of where my values are and aren't. So I have made sure to fight to save the family farm, but also in saving the family farm and closing some loopholes in farming and the way that we do probate law, I have also been able to, pretty soon here, the governor is soon to sign after we do one more vote in the House, ensure that property that is in families stays in families. And that's something that our rural areas really need.
Hey, can you talk about that a little more? Because I wanted to congratulate you on that big news there. So can you talk about that bill?
The Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act is a piece of legislation that's been passed in many states across the country and our territories. And depending on the state, it's been introduced by a Democrat or a Republican. And the kinds of stakeholders that are really strongly in support of this are incredibly diverse. They vary from civil rights leaders to farm advocates to really folks that work on poverty. And what it does is it establishes a process for property to stay within a family when there is no legal will. Often our families that are low income have lack of access to legal representation, and that makes it easy for property to shift from somebody who owns the property and then dies to prospective developers or to local governments who can then sell the property at fire sale prices. And we know that generational equity is built in great part, especially for poor people, through holding on to land and holding on to houses and farms. My interest in this came from seeing a lot of the obstacles that our rural areas are facing and losing small family farms, but it also came from a historical example that has led to the loss of over 90% of Black farms since 1910. This loophole being open has allowed for a really easy steal from Black and Brown farmers who traditionally, and even to this day, lack legal counsel. This legislation also would save right now over 5,000 homes who are at risk of being sent to fire sale due to lack of will in the city of Detroit. So it addresses the housing crisis, and it also helps to support our small family farms.
How did you become aware of this issue and then decide that, hey, this is something that you really wanted to tackle while you're there?
I came into office recognizing the incredible new territory we had after redistricting and looked at how much rural area I had and have pretty strong feelings about how everybody should have access to getting into agriculture, to having support in being successful in agriculture and keeping their farm stable. It is a very difficult thing to be a farmer these days, especially if a small farmer. But I also had worked closely already with our urban farms within the city of Lansing and saw how difficult it is for folks to acquire land and then hold on to land. So I saw that as a common denominator. If there's one thing we can't go without, I mean, among many things, I'm a basic needs fighter. It is access to food, and keeping food local became especially important during the breaks in the supply chain during COVID. This was a real opportunity for us to draw attention to the strength that we have in our food systems when we find food close to home, but also when we get it from people we know.
And of course, I mean, this got bipartisan support, and you said there's one more vote to be had, right, in the House? Is that correct?
Yeah. So there's a concurrence vote just in the House to make sure that we have adopted all uniform language. One interesting event that happened with this legislation, you are correct. You are absolutely correct. This bill has been unanimously supported in committee in both chambers. In both chambers, it received 100% of the votes on the floor in both the House and the Senate. When it came back to us the other day, it was actually on the agenda and Republicans refused to vote for it because we had Democratic members missing. They essentially said, if you can't have all of your votes, you're not getting any of ours. So that speaks to the culture and climate that we're in for the next 6 weeks, not even 6 weeks. We really only have 9 more days of session. This is a piece of legislation that was supported by every Republican, and they refused to entertain voting it through its final step unless we had all of our members there. And I'm never going to defend us not being at work. We should all be showing up for work, especially right now. But we also have a Republican legislature that is about to take power and is not going to be giving us anything. There is also a possibility it's pretty clearly agreed that this is good legislation, that they would try to introduce anything that we can't be there for with our own members in attendance next session. And this is something that's really necessary right now, especially in light of the housing crisis.
Okay, so that's got to be frustrating.
You know, it is incredibly frustrating. It's right up there with just us not doing things that we know are of really urgent need right now. But in this case, we all agree that it's really important. It's really logical. It would have immediate positive effects for everybody, regardless of where they are in our communities. And it is right now being held up by playing games with each other. So I hope that that is not the kind of politics that we are going to go back to.
And what's, I guess, even more frustrating is we heard from voters who either went on the Democratic side or went on the Republican side who said that they just don't feel like politicians are hearing them, especially when it comes to the economy and how it's affecting the working class. And this is legislation that actually is doing that. And then what's our state legislature doing? Not really, like you said, they're playing games and not really hearing the people.
Yeah. And there is so much to do. I don't know if there are many people that you would run into on a daily basis that aren't struggling right now. Everything is just unaffordable. But when it comes down to it, housing and our most necessary forms of property and basic needs are especially unaffordable right now. So we have to meet the needs. We have to meet this moment and just do what is best for our constituents and think ahead a bit, considering what we have coming in January.
Representative Dierendorf, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind just staying on the topic of agriculture just for one more question here. Since you've already said that saving family farms and also dealing with food insecurity are two major issues that you have been focusing on while in Lansing, and you know, you've already said that agriculture was something that you weren't real familiar with at first. So how did you become more knowledgeable and educate yourself on the agricultural world here in Michigan and agribusiness and also just family farming. How did that process all go about? Was that something that you had to kind of learn on the fly?
It absolutely is. I'm not going to claim I started out an expert in ag. I'm not going to pretend I still am I am currently an expert in ag, but I came in committed to doing the research. What would bring our communities together? And I looked at what a progressive farming policy would address. And progressive farming is sustainable, it is equitable, and it supports our families. It supports people in accessing their most basic needs. So I did do some research on what was passing around the country on these issues. And there are so many things we can do in agriculture that would be really positive and would help everybody, including investing more in regenerative agriculture policies and education and supporting our farmers every step of the way, getting into farming, getting the training that they need, getting business development skills, acquiring land, and then learning about marketing. There is a lot that we do for a traditional entrepreneur and business in other realms that we don't do for farmers when we really are running out of small family farms. So I did do some research. I actually found the State Innovation Exchange has a fantastic website on how we can do farming in a progressive way. And I have found that really helpful.
Outstanding. Well, Representative Diebendorf, you know, I've been covering some of what is or isn't happening in the lame duck session, as we've just been talking about here, as you and your Democratic colleagues are trying to get some of these bills passed before you have to give up the majority. And I know one bill, because we talked about the last time you're here, but the one bill that you've been really fighting hard to pass is also a homeless bill of rights bill. And if I read correctly, I think it was late last week that your bill did get voted out of a subcommittee last week. Can you talk more about that and why it's a priority of yours and for everyone to really get this bill across the finish line before the end of the year?
Yeah, so I am vice chair of our subcommittee on housing, and I've been a champion of addressing the housing crisis in a holistic and comprehensive way, which means while I absolutely support building more, because we have not enough roofs to go over people's heads. That's just the reality of the situation right now, and housing is really unaffordable. We are not maintaining the aging housing stack that we have, and we have obstacles to housing, like still some sanctioned discrimination. I started to dig into, again, what my community wanted and what they were experiencing. And we might have talked about before, I kind of joke with my staff that I'd have my own kind of walkabouts. I wasn't driving for a couple of years because I have epilepsy. So the first year and a half of my time in the legislature, I was walking to work. And when I walked home, I would continue walking. And I started to have one-on-one conversations, not even one-on-one. Sometimes it was me talking to 10 different people at a time, at a table or in the park or under a bridge, about what they were experiencing. And frankly, what I found really frustrating, and it made me sad, but it was very understandable, is that our unhoused community members don't expect us to resource them in a humane way. They are so used to just being put out of sight in order to be out of mind because of our own internalized whatever. We could go into that whole thing that they don't expect us to do what is right for them. For as much as we talk about how, at the very least, we should be caring for our homeless populations, we hear about it at church, we talk about it in the community, and then we'd pass all kinds of measures, especially in response to the Supreme Court Grants Pass decision on folks sleeping outside. A lot of knee-jerk reactions that push people out of the way. So I started to see a absolutely essential need for us to respond in humane and effective ways to resourcing our community members who are homeless because we don't have anywhere for them to go. And one of the things that I really learned through all of these one-on-one conversations that continue to this day, like I will show up and folks know who I am and what I'm there for, and I'm there to listen. I learned that everybody has a good reason for why they are not going into shelters. If they're not going into shelters, there's a lot of PTSD. There's a lot of claustrophobia. But there are also so many things that we just don't get to the bottom of because we don't work on getting to the root causes of homelessness. We have to acknowledge the reality of who is living where, who doesn't have a home and why, while we shift people into permanent housing. So the Homeless Bill of Rights was created in order to set a baseline standard for how we treat our neighbors humanely and to give them the legal right to have equal access to all of the resources and services that the average person has. Moving freely in public spaces, the right to privacy, the right to personal belongings, the right to health care, all of these different things, the right to an education and to get to school if you're a child. We have more kids homeless right now than we've seen in so long. So just setting a baseline standard so that we don't respond in these, frankly, counterproductive ways to resourcing our homeless neighbors.
Is it tough to I don't know how to exactly phrase this, but is it tough to maybe get full support behind an action like this or behind a bill like yours because of some who may have a bias or be it implicit bias against homeless people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our biases somewhat lead on this issue. And I've lost patience for it. You know, I think that a lot of us don't want to acknowledge how hard it is for other folks or have a hard time with it. I think that we internalize our own guilt, our own frustrations with how hard other people are having. But it gets to a place where we shouldn't have to explain to somebody why we should treat somebody, especially who is struggling the most, among our neighbors who are struggling the most, humanely and kindly and with responses that actually address their need. It's hard and frustrating to try to convince another person that they should care about somebody that is so clearly having one of the worst times of their lives. That has been just bewildering for me. It hasn't been a surprise because I know what we're up against, but we don't have any time for it. It's getting cold. It's getting cold. We're in the middle of a housing crisis. At some point, we have to live by our values. We have to not be hypocrites. We have to actually put action into what we say about what our values and our ideals are. And at the bare minimum, all of us claim to care about homelessness, and yet we don't allow or encourage our communities to respond with holistic wraparound services, with allowing people to sit in one place. Instead, we are regularly sweeping encampments, picking people's stuff up, throwing it away. People are losing IDs. People are losing everything they own and then shifted down the river because there just isn't enough room in a shelter. So to me, this is about just accepting the reality that is, while we're getting people what they need to really get to the root of this, because housing and homelessness is not rocket science. We know how to end it. It's just a matter of will and resources.
Let's talk about housing real quick. If you had, maybe this will be a two-part question. If you had a magic wand to make housing more affordable, what would you like to see be done? And do you think you and your Democratic colleagues are going to be able to really address the housing crisis and the housing issue before the land is all up?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I don't know what we're going to be willing or able to do. I know that there are dozens of housing bills out there. I know that because I at least put dozens of housing bills on the table. And we have some that are essential to this moment. We should absolutely be investing more money in building affordable housing. But we need to, and not just middle income housing, affordable housing. We need to be trying to put forth more money for rental assistance programs because a lot of that money has dried up. We had a good number of programs for the federal government during COVID that have now evaporated. And after homelessness has exploded, we have tenants who are lacking a right to legal counsel. And we have legal services agencies that are at capacity and very much underfunded. We also still see discrimination in getting into housing for folks with criminal records. And we are fighting for our tenants' right to organize and to have standards in what a healthy, safe living situation is. There are so many things we need to do in addition to building housing, but we can do all these things at one time. Like, we can really walk and chew gum, because if we only address one corner of our housing crisis with one approach, really, it is still going to be a vulnerable and crisis situation. We have to address it at all levels in all of these different ways, or we're just putting a Band-Aid on one thing that we don't want to work on anymore.
So, obviously, everybody who's listening to this, they know what happened here at the election.
Yeah.
And the last time I had you on at the end of 2023, you talked about hoping to push the Overton window, you know, back towards more the common sense side after 40 years of Republican rule, you know, in the state of Michigan and of, let's just face it, conservative messaging throughout the country. So I guess maybe my question is, do you believe that you and your Democratic colleagues were able to find some success in shifting that window while you had the majority, or were there some wasted opportunities, or a little of both?
I was so very much hoping you would ask about this. So I think that to a great degree, we have had the opportunity to shift the Overton window in an internal and organized capacity, in an internal way within the Democratic caucus. We saw real collaboration and organizing among our more progressive legislators for exactly the kinds of changes we wanted to see coming in. almost half the caucus were brand new legislators in the House, in the House Democratic Caucus. And we came in wanting a more participatory and representative democracy. We wanted more input and involvement from our communities, but we also wanted to model government the way we know government should function so that people could start to trust government again. There obviously are disagreements now about how people feel about the fact that that happened. I personally don't think it was a bad thing for us to have higher standards. But I also come from having worked on progressive politics and organizing and civil rights, from us being in the minority in the House to the majority, to the minority, to the majority, to the minority, and still having to make progress, having to accept that you can't stop working on progress and building that public understanding and shifting towards more and better, regardless of who's in charge. And when you have the power, you have to also have courage. Now, I was obviously invited back in my community, and I put on my campaign literature that I want more humane immigration policies. This is not Ann Arbor.
Right.
Lansing is not Ann Arbor, but I am listening to folks that still do not have the right to organize under Michigan law. We have exemptions under Michigan law for domestic and agricultural workers, whom we also depend on very much for the strength of our and the functioning of our economy and, again, our food systems. And we know that in January, we are going to have a lot of xenophobic inspired policy. So as far as I'm concerned, advocating for those that are most vulnerable and a better democracy really helped to build the trust in communities like mine. I have people coming to me who say, you know, we weren't sure what you were going to be like as a legislator. We really wanted to think you would represent everybody. And thank you. Faith was restored. And that isn't because I'm doing it all myself. It's because I am in regular communication with them. And I'm not afraid to say to my colleagues and in the legislature, no, this is what folks need. Like, at the very least, we need to serve those folks that are the most vulnerable right now and do that with courage. And they are the ones who are starting to disengage as they lose faith in us. So I do think we had great success in that. Where I am frustrated is that we face a moment where moderate Democrats would like to blame progressives for us losing control of the House. That just simply is not the case. We did not have a majority that prioritized and centered progressive policies. We had to fight like hell to try to shift anything towards progressive values. If anything, if we made any mistake, we led with a lot of apprehension and fear, and we have left a lot of our Democratic friends and allies feeling disillusioned and left out. We need to do criminal justice reform still. We need to do housing. We need to work on civil rights in several layers, in several realms for different communities. And we have not done that as much as we could have with the power that we had. I'm worried that because we have painted progressives as wrenches in the system, when it's really what progressive policies are, really what our communities wanted, that we're going to end up leaving this legislative session with a lot of the folks most in need who were already questioning whether they could have leaders that represent them that much more disengaged from politics.
Which is exactly the opposite of what we've always been advocating for. We wanted to try to get as many people involved in politics. It's also kind of depressing from just what I'm hearing from listeners and also even from some of your colleagues who think, hey, you know what? It seems like in Lansing, it's more about who's lobbying than actually fighting for the common everyday working Michigander. I don't know. Is that your viewpoint?
That's absolutely the feeling. And I do think that over the last 2 years, courage has been growing. And you know that that's important to me. Courage has been growing to stand up to corporate interests, but money in politics is still a huge problem. I am never offended when advocacy organizations or even lobbyists come to me and pressure me to do something. It is on me to do the right thing, to fully research an issue, and also to get to know the experiences of my community and what best practices and the most effective solutions look like. None of us should be swayed by any one stakeholder. But the fact is, we are consistently pushing away those voices that represent the most in need, who frankly don't have a lot of money to pour into a lobbying effort. So the citizen lobbying is how any kind of communication is done with a lot of our legislators. We are pushing those folks away because legislators, I'm just going to say it, get really easily offended by somebody saying, hey, you know, we don't think you did that the best. We would really like you to do better. We'd really like you to do more on this. this is not a culture that is very receptive to that. So letter writing campaigns, the demands of our housing advocates, I see a lot of people taking offense to pressure when that is literally our job. But when we have big tech companies coming in and saying, no, you really have to do this now. You have to do this now, whether it's going to hurt the potential of winning in the election. We have to do this now, whether it compromises your values. Then suddenly it is at the top of our agenda and we're spending whole days in session on it. And that just, it's not ethical. It's not helping to build trust in us, but it is a very clear example of how money in politics has gotten in the way of our willingness to do the right thing.
My final question, and thanks so much for staying on here. I appreciate it. You know, last week on the show, I was talking with Livingston County progressive activist Casey Helton, and we agreed that the Democratic Party, both on a national and state level, like you and I have just been talking about, must try to really reclaim, you know, the working class vote. Because, hey, that's what the Democratic Party used to be always about, you know, back in FDR days and JFK and LBJ days. And of course, you know, here in the state with union support and all that. But while passing bills and helping the working class is important, I'm still very despondent, Representative, about this election, because I think it's mostly because that such a hate-filled messaging machine from the MAGA Republican side, this hate-filled machine that just views people that aren't like them as, you know, as different or as the other, that kind of hate filled machine won the election. And so finally, maybe I could just get your feelings on that subject. And, you know, where should progressives go on from here?
So I share your despondency. I just haven't paused long enough to feel yet. I'm preparing myself for the moment that I let myself take a breath, because it is all going to sink in. None of this surprises me, though. We've been here before. And I understand, like, my background is in civil rights. Hate is what I'm used to working on. One of my frustrations throughout this election is I absolutely don't want us to lead without hope. You know, we should be talking about the possibilities. But I also have run municipal ballot campaigns to protect human rights ordinances. That is also a part of my experience. And one of the things that we know working in national civil rights movements is that hate inspires people to vote. Hate and fear inspire people to vote. That provides a lot of momentum and hope. As wonderful it is, and I'm never going to give up on it, but hope often leaves us assuming that if we are tired that evening, that our neighbor's going to get out and vote the right way, because we believe in the right side of history. We can believe in the right side of history and still fight like hell for what we know is right and for the standard that we all know we need to meet. I've noticed that in these post-election interviews, there are a lot of Trump supporters who say, no, you know, I don't agree with the misogynistic, xenophobic, racist rhetoric or the jokes that he tells, but ha ha ha, he's a media personality and they're just jokes. But then we get to this moment and we see who all of these appointments are. And they are actual white supremacists. They are folks who believe in conspiracy theories and don't believe in science. We need to take seriously when somebody tells us who they are, whether that's through inaction or actually vocalizing what their values are. And we have gotten to such a point of desensitization and not taking much seriously because we've been so inundated by hate since the first time he ran that we don't even apply those looming threats to the potential for our own lives anymore. We just assume that it's showmanship. Rhetoric is harmful, which is not me saying that we shut people up in sharing how they feel, but we should take seriously that rhetoric can speak to ideology and ideology can speak to values, and values will dictate public policy, will dictate what our daily lives look like. And right now we are in a very scary situation. I don't mind at all that you're despondent. I think it's totally understandable that people are tired, that people are picking themselves up. I think people should take the time they need to nurture the fight in themselves and to care for themselves however they should, in great part because we're going to need as much energy as any of us can muster. We need to get back to a fighting place. We need to get back to a place where we fight for the standard and, yes, soul of this country and a functioning democracy. One thing that I read just recently, and I'm sure you did too, is that our incoming president is trying to skip over the Senate in approving his appointments. We are already eliminating necessary processes that exist in order to provide checks and balances. We need to spend these couple of years getting control over our democracy back. And one great way to do that is to keep the people involved.
Well, let me just say that despite how this election went for many of us here in Michigan and millions across the country, it is great to know that there are some bright spots to this election. You are one of the bright spots, and including some other great progressives in the State House who were able to keep their seats as well. So, State Representative Emily Diefendorf, thank you so much for staying in the fight, for being a voice for the voiceless, and for your steadfastness to, as you just said, fight for the soul of this country. Thanks for being on this week, and I'd love to have you back on in the future.
Yeah, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
He spent nearly 25 years working as a liberal voice in conservative talk radio across the state, and he's still a somewhat stable person. It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. You can find archives of the podcast, plus Pat's musings on other topics in written form at leftoflansing.com. Left of Lansing archives are available wherever you get your podcasts. And now Left of Lansing is available on YouTube. We'd like to thank Audioboom for distributing all our episodes so we can share progressive, otherwise known as common sense, values across Michigan and the country. Now, here's Pat Johnston.
I know that the next couple of years are going to be tough for a good number of Michiganders and people around the United States of America. But knowing that we have strong progressive voices and strong progressive fighters like Emily Diefendorf in our state legislature does, in fact, give me hope. There is hope for the soul of the country, as Representative Diefendorf just put it. My thanks to the representative for being on this week. Time now for a Left of Lansing last call. I did want to take a brief moment talking about something that's really, really, really been getting on me here this week. Listen.
For fighting to protect women and girls, it's ridiculous. So if that being a feminist makes me an extremist, I'm totally here for it.
Is this effort in response to Congresswoman McBride coming to Congress?
Yes, and absolutely, and then some. I'm not going to stand for a man. If someone with a penis is in the women's locker room, that's not okay. And I'm a victim of abuse myself. I'm a rape survivor. I have PTSD from the abuse I've suffered at the hands of a man. And I know how vulnerable women and girls are in private spaces. So I'm absolutely 100% going to stand in the way of any man who wants to be in a women's restroom, in our locker rooms, in our changing rooms. I will be there fighting you every step of the way.
That was South Carolina MAGA nutjob Congresswoman Nancy Mace being as disgusting as ever, as she announced that she's introducing a resolution banning transgender women from using the women's bathroom in the U.S. Capitol building. Because, hey, what's freedom in the U.S. Capitol building, right? This was a sick response to incoming Democratic freshman Congresswoman Sarah McBride's victory in Delaware a few weeks ago. McBride is a transgender woman and is being singled out by MAGA Republicans in their hate-filled, prejudiced, ignorant crusade against people they don't deem, quote unquote, normal. But wait, I thought this election was about the working people and about tackling inflation. How does attacking the only transgender member of Congress help working people again? All right, it doesn't. They never had economic plans to help working Americans. They never had that. Republicans don't care about that. They just plan to attack the trans community and the entire LGBTQ plus community as a whole. Speaker and Trump waterboy Mike Johnson announced that he is also backing Mace's proposal because discrimination and hating on people is supposedly the Christian way. I mean, I hear Jesus talk that way all the time. And Nancy Mace saying that she doesn't feel safe with transgender women in the bathrooms. Oh, really? But you feel safe with Matt Gaetz? You feel safe with Dear Leader Trump? Really? 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 But you see, this is what happens when Democrats capitulate and say nothing in defense of people who don't have the power or the means to defend themselves. Democrats should always be defending the trans community, and that they stayed silent during the entire election is coming home to hurt them. Their silence emboldened MAGA Republicans. You see, they said it was about sports. No, it wasn't. The goal was to always attack and further marginalize the trans community. It was to make trans people the other and to paint them as scary. And there was no pushback from the Democrats. None. And you know what? I'll look in the mirror. I'll take ownership of that because I guess I just didn't want to believe some people could be swayed by those anti-trans ads run by Trump and the Republicans during the election. And I really didn't talk about it here because I thought that's ridiculous. No one's going to really vote on this issue. Still, though, I was wrong, and there should have been pushback. Like, why are Republicans always, always, always wanting to check your child's genitals in the locker room? I mean, it was a perfect, perfect opportunity to use Tim Walz's "they're weird" card, and Democrats didn't. They weren't there. They weren't there to protect the trans community. And now Republicans feel emboldened to run their sick brand. There should have been a strong defense for trans Americans up and down the ballot. But when it comes to strength, many in the Democratic leadership just cry mercy. When will they ever learn? Even better yet, when will we learn?
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Thanks once again to Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf for being on this week. I'll keep tabs on what's happening in Lansing, but please contact your local representative, especially Democratic State Representatives, and tell them to get moving on those lame duck bills. Tell them to pass those bills helping hardworking Michiganders rather than always trying to help corporate donors. Tell them to work for the people. Okay, so I'm breaking a rule of mine this year, but it's a rule I feel needs to be broken, and I don't believe I'm the only one. This weekend, we're putting up our Christmas lights outside. Normally, I wait until after Thanksgiving, but with Thanksgiving being late this year and because of the state of the country, I really need something to make me feel a little better. So Christmas lights are going up earlier this year. Hey, but for the rest of you, do what you have to do for your sanity and to help make you feel a little better. Because remember, as Representative Diefendorf said, soon we will all have to get back into the fight to show solidarity against Trump and MAGA corporate autocracy and downright fascism. Until next week, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.